tonight on Arena. Andrea Riseborough on her role in the film Here Before, which opens the Galway Film Flat tonight. And Rory Cashin asks and answers, Where Do I Begin with Wes Anderson? #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The 33rd Galway Film Flat kicks off tonight. This year, screenings will happen at an outdoor cinema in Father Burke Park and online. The opening film will be the European premiere of Here Before, the feature debut from Belfast television writer, filmmaker and playwright Stacey Gregg. The film is a psychological thriller starring Andrea Riseborough as a bereaved mother who begins to think she has encountered the reincarnation of her dead daughter with the arrival of new next-door neighbours. Delighted to be joined on the line by Andrea Riseborough from London this evening. This is quite a script. Did you know much about Stacey Gregg before this? You got your hands on this script, Andrea, or was this your first encounter with her?
I did, yeah. I knew of her theatre work because I, you know, we both sort of come from a similar place. I sort of had a classical drama training, you know, at drama school. So, yeah, I knew about her work. You know, she was also an actor as well, and so she was writing, she was in plays, she was directing plays. She's just a really extraordinary theatre director, and really from the first moment that we met one another, I felt in utterly safe hands with her. Mm. And also, like, there was a kinship, you know, we were coming from the same place.
Yeah, they're, even as you describe it there, you sound to me, from what I know of you and of your work, you sound to me as if you're in a very similar spot, or very, you come from a very similar sensibility as Stacey. Mm. And what really struck me about this film, the character that you play, Laura, this bereaved mother, obviously heartbroken at the death of her daughter, and you can understand why, when a little girl appears next door, why she might want to try to get close to her and want to, you know, build some kind of a relationship with her. But what Stacey does in the writing, and I think you do in the performing, is that this never goes anywhere near kind of, you know, Twilight Zone type of area, or there's a supernatural element, but it's always rooted in reality, and that's so important to keeping the audience hooked, I think.
Mm. I mean, it's really a very compelling portrait of grief. If I were to sort of describe it to anyone, I know that probably you wouldn't use that to a distribution company might not use that to sell the film, but that really is at its heart what it is, and the magical thinking that comes along with grief. And I think it being set where it is, the whole thing, you were talking about it being very rooted, the whole thing felt that way as we were making it. It read that way on the page. And Stacey herself is very rooted to the land, you know, where she's from, the environment, the you know, the beautiful, beautiful land around Belfast, in Belfast. And it couldn't have been anywhere else. It couldn't have taken place anywhere else. Although it feels like the tumult is happening in the sky as much as it is in Laura's psyche, you know.
Yeah, but it wouldn't be 1,000 miles away in feeling, I would have thought, than from your native Newcastle and the area which I would associate you at any rate. There's a very similar feeling, I would guess, in both places, both cities.
I was thinking about that today before we talked, because I was thinking about what it is that keeps bringing me back to Belfast and to Northern Ireland and to Ireland, because I've done a lot of work there. Mm. And I think with Belfast, I feel really so at home in Belfast, always have from the moment that I first arrived. And I made a film probably about 10 years ago now called Shadow Dancer, which we actually was set in Belfast, but we filmed in Dublin. And it was very frustrating for me at the time that we couldn't shoot it in Belfast, because I would travel up to Belfast every night and then on the weekends as well to try and be there and stay in that, you know, headspace, and then come back down to Dublin and shoot. But I've always felt a huge kinship, like with Stacey, with the place. And recently, actually, my mum was doing some family history stuff, and there was one relative, my dad's mum's mum, who just, it seemed, we couldn't find a birth certificate for her or a marriage certificate or anything. It seemed like she just landed from planet Zog, you know, like, was really confused about where she'd come from. It turned out that she I think probably did come from Northern Ireland. So perhaps there's something,
yeah, something there in the blood.
Deep in there, yeah, and, that draws me back.
Yeah, for sure. And one of the things that struck me again in your performance, it's a notoriously difficult accent to pin down, but then I guess you're well used to hearing people mangle the Geordie accent, so you maybe you took a bit of extra care in pinning this one down. Let's have a listen to a clip, if we could. And this is of yourself, obviously, Andrea, in here, and your husband, Brendan, played by John Joe O'Neill. And at this point in proceedings, it's early enough on, you've met the little girl next door. She's been left standing outside the school. You've given her a lift home, and there's been a few conversations in the car, but she's kind of discombobulated you with talk about knowing certain parts of the locality. So you talk to Brendan, the husband, about that, and there's mention of Tig in here as well. Tig is Brendan, and you're Brendan and Laura's son. Let's listen.
What's that about? Sitting in there, face tripping him.
It was rude.
Have you not met our son? To be honest, I think he's entitled not to want some wee girl coming over. What is it?
The other night, she was waiting for me to do ketchup face.
Yeah. She'd be about the same age.
When I was giving her a lift home, we were passing the graveyard.
What, when Marie was late?
Yeah. Have you met her?
No. A cup of tea?
That's John Joe O'Neill as Brendan and Andrea Riceborough as Laura in a clip there from Here Before, the film which opens tonight's Galway Film Fly. I'm delighted to be speaking with Andrea Riceborough this evening. Well, I'm sure it's the same in Newcastle. A cup of tea will solve most things, won't it?
I love that he ends or breaks off with the question of a cup of tea. Yeah.
Yeah,
kind of. Recently, my other half is from Lebanon, and recently he burnt himself quite badly, touched something really hot in the kitchen. And instead of helping him, I immediately turned the kettle on. I said, there's not a word of a lie. This is actually what I did. I turned the kettle on, and he was like, "What are you doing?" And I was like, "It was just my first instinct."
Well, that's another. Obviously, that's from the Belfast ancestry for sure. That's coming in there. But the other thing that scene gives us, though, is you know the sense of the simple things that Stacey seems to be able to get into her script, which is, you know, ordinary life just tippling along the way it does. But there's mention there of the daughter. And I wondered, given what you told me, Andrea, about when you were shooting in Dublin with the, you know, the Shadowlands set up in Belfast, given that you went back up to Belfast to get the feel of it, how much did you do for yourself in terms of imagining, you know, that daughter who had died, Laura's daughter who had died? We don't get all of the details on it in the script, but we're in the film, but we're aware of it all the time.
Yeah, often when we were shooting, I talked to Stacey about this. Actually, not often, because in a way, I think we're both having our own emotional, internal experience with it. But, you know, when we sometimes have a moment to chat in between takes. I think a couple of times I mentioned to her, it was very strange having the closest relationship be with somebody who's passed away. You know, the closest, the person really that Laura's in relationship most intensely with is no longer alive. And John Didion wrote a wonderful book, very, very well-known book called The Year of Magical Thinking, which I'm sure you've had a look at. And she talks about the magical thinking that comes along with grief. And I think one of the things that Stacey captures so beautifully is that as we're all walking around in the most pedestrian way in life, this is for all of those people, all of those parents who have lost a child, all of those people who, at the end of the day, you know, most of your experience is what's happening in your head and your perception of the world, right? A very small part of your experience is what's happening outside of that, because you are sort of innately trapped inside of yourself. So there are people going through things all over the place and having these really quite magical, extraordinary thoughts in order to be able to deal with whatever they're going through. And Stacey gives us a very realistic look into that, I think.
And it comes back again to that you will use the word realistic there. And that was the thing that, again, appealed to me about the film in particular, was this, you know, when those little, whatever it might be, you know, the smallest of things, like a little feather falling into your hand, or, you know, many people talk about when a robin appears outside a window, and if a loved one has died recently, they'll often think of that the robin is some kind of message coming back. But it's always played by you and written by Stacey in a way that there is no sense of, you know, there's no suddenly ominous music rolling in underneath what's happening. We just get a sense that this is a woman dealing with the loss that she's had to deal with in the best way she possibly can.
There's not a phrase or a word or a beat that's not thought out on Stacey's part. I truly think she is one of the strongest sort of writers in the UK and Ireland. Really, I think she's really an extraordinary writer.
How much do you think, you talked about your own theatre background, you know, and for many actors, it starts out in theatre, and if you're lucky enough then to get the television and film breaks, that can either take over or provide you with the facility, the simple financial facility, to do the plays that you want to at another stage. To what extent do you think that theatrical background, particularly in the case of Stacey now and in your own case, how does that feed into specifically into the type of film work that you choose to do and want to do?
I mean, it's affected me in every way. I think the most natural transition is probably from theatre to film. And those are the two things that I know best. I sort of understand television a little less. That part of Stacey's brain is very muscular, and she, very, you know, she really understands episodic narrative. For me, I feel much more at ease, I think, in, you know, either in the theatre or in a film. But my theatre experience, which in every way informs anything that I do in film, started actually at a place called the People's Theatre, the Youth Theatre in Newcastle. And we had a summer program with the Galway Youth Theatre. And so when I was a kid, I went to Galway and we did an exchange program where the Galway Youth Theatre went to Newcastle and we went to Galway. When I heard that this was, that we were opening the Galway Film Festival, I was so excited because funnily enough, even though it's the film festival, it makes me think so very much of theatre. And I know Galway has that, like, it's just pulsating with creativity. It's one of those places, it's just an intersection for so many different types of creativity. And so it felt really full circle almost.
Yeah, there's a sense
that we're now having this film at the Galway Film Festival.
Yeah. Was 000, by the way, with Gabriel Byrne, who also is going to be at the Fly, there's going to be an In Conversation event featuring Gabriel. You worked with Gabriel on 000. Was that television or was that a film?
That was television.
Yeah. You played father and daughter, wealthy shipping family involved in cocaine trafficking. Now, obviously, we may be a little biased in this part of the world about Gabriel Byrne, but just talk to me a little bit about your experience of working with him on that television series.
He's extraordinary. You know, I've already used that word to describe Stacey, so now it sounds totally lacks any sort of genuine genuine meaning, but that's not what I intended. He's a really, really inspiring person. I think that's the thing that struck me about working with him more than anything, is he has this very soulful, quite slow rhythm. And I don't mean, you know, he has a very, very quick mind, but he has a sort of a calm, slow rhythm as a human, you know, and this ability to really have everything else around him almost, you know, gravitate toward that rhythm. I don't know whether I'm articulating it very well at all, but he's quite an inspiring person for that reason. I have a tendency, I'll spend 10 minutes with someone, I'll speak in a Liverpoolian accent accidentally, you know, and start talking 60 times faster than I normally do. I'm a sort of sponge. I find it hard to almost keep hold of myself. whereas he has this real gravity, you know.
Well, it's funny because that quality that you're talking about, because I'll come back to the film and to Here Before just as we finish up, that quality that you're talking about is what I think is there in the film. This idea of possibly, if we're not both making decisions about how Gabriel Byrne acts, but this ability to maybe to wait for something to come to you rather than forcing something out and saying, oh, well, this will have this effect, this will make the audience feel it. If you just wait and let the moment happen, and it struck me that Here Before seemed to have that type of patience, maybe something similar to what you're talking about with Gabriel Byrne.
I hope so. I hope so. I mean, I think that's what we all strive for. It's really interesting, I think, to tell something. I think what people really respond to more than above anything else is authenticity. And I think we can sniff it out as humans. Of course, we're very used to having the sort of cinematic language or television language, episodic language that we're used to hearing that can be very comforting. But I think with a writer like Stacey, it was always going to represent something that hadn't been seen before but was incredibly familiar. It hadn't necessarily been captured on film in that way. Why not capture the experience of a mother in the suburbs of Belfast? And the grief that she's going through, having lost her daughter. It's not even in the sensational moments of losing the daughter. It's not a sensational film. Stacey treats Laura's grief and the grief that she imagines that many people have been through with a lot more respect than that.
Yeah, indeed she does, as do you. You've been very kind to her, and I'm sure she would want to be very kind to you in terms of the performance as well. Lovely to have spoken with you this evening, Andrea. Pity that you can't be in Galway, but I hope it's because you're doing work that you're very excited about in London, and that we'll see the fruits of that soon.
I wish I could be in Galway. I'd have a Guinness for me, sit outside on that green, you know, listen to some music, and I'll be there in spirit.
All right. Well, listen, we're going to finish up with the second clip from Here Before, and this is where you meet Marie. Marie is the mother of the little girl next door. You're in the supermarket, and there's been a little bit of a barney about Tig giving out about the little girl coming over to the house. But your character, Andrea, Laura, she's curious as to why the little girl seems to think that she's lived in this area before. So it's Andrea Riseborough as Laura and Eileen O'Higgins in the character of Marie.
I'm sorry about giving over by Tig. Why was I to know Megan wasn't making it up?
Oh, sure.
But like, I had to have a wee chat with her teacher. We're hardly here a month.
Is everything okay?
Okay, yeah. They just have them writing these journals, you know.
Aye, Josie did one. All the kids do them at school. My daughter, she's not with us anymore.
Tig did one too.
Well, teacher asked us if the things she was writing were all true, and she says yes. Got into a bit of a barney. I mean, who cares? It's only a kid, right?
Yeah, it's not so strange.
Aye, it's just... It's not like wacky things, like going to Disneyland or shooting your teacher with a bazooka. To know it's probably just who he is. It just made me think maybe she's torturing your Tig or something. Anyway, we'll hear about it, get on.
You know, Megan did say something to me. It's funny, she said she's been to school here before.
Well, she's never been here. Not even from Antrim.
Yeah? Strange. And she said, just been to the graveyard. I mean, how do you explain...
She's lying, miss. Look, that's what kids are like. Well, here, I better get on, because our Chris will be wondering where I am. Hi, Laura. Cheerio.
There you go, Eileen O'Higgins and Andrea Riseborough in that scene from Stacey Gregg's film Here Before. The film, in fact, opened the Galway Film Fla about 23 and a half minutes ago, 7 o'clock. That screening was due to start at the outdoor screening at Father Burke Park on Father Griffin Road in Galway. But you can see it online, the film. It'll be available from 8 p.m. this evening, Here Before, and you can find out full details about that and everything happening at the Fla on galwayfilmfla.com. And indeed, we will be going to Galway and our Galway studio shortly to speak with the writer and director Conor O'Toole and star Roxana McLean of a film called Bicycle Thieves Pumped Up. That is on the way shortly. And yes, indeed, we're staying with Galway and the Galway film Fla. Bicycle Thieves Pumped Up is the title of a new Irish film from writer and director Conor O'Toole. The film centres around a hot-headed pizza delivery girl called Mags, played by Roxana McLean. Mags's job, livelihood and accommodation are threatened when her bicycle is stolen. And on her journey to recover that bike, she encounters a range of characters, chancers and crooks, many of them played by the cream of Irish comedy. Alison Spittle is there, Maeve Higgins is there, as is Tara Flynn, lots of others as well. Bicycle Thieves Pumped Up will be screened outdoors this Thursday evening as part of the Galway Film Fla. And joining us from our Galway studio right now, writer and director Conor O'Toole and the woman at the centre of the story, Roxana McLean. First things first for you, this one, Conor, Bicycle Thieves, mm-hmm. with no Pumped Up afterwards, was directed by Vittorio De Sica in 1948. So at what point did you realise that and say, I don't care, I'm calling it this anyway?
Yeah, I've heard it's good. I should check it out. What'd you say? Yeah, no, it's funny. I didn't actually go into this intending to make a remake of Bicycle Thieves. And then after I finished it, I was like, this is actually a bit like Bicycle Thieves, isn't it? And then I thought it would be funny if the Vittorio De Sica family sued us. He hasn't come around yet. Well, but, you know,
you got a
big bag of money by the door.
Yeah, but you quite cleverly stuck Pumped Up on to the end of it. And I guess that makes it a totally different film. And
absolutely
you,
unrelated.
Yes. And your character, Roxana, Pumped Up in some ways, could refer to her. She's quite worked up more or less throughout the film, really, isn't she?
Yeah, well, to be honest, if you've ever spent a day cycling around Dublin, then you would 100% agree with every single thing that Mags is angry about in this film.
Are you a cyclist yourself, yeah?
Me and Connor were talking about this distinction earlier on. I'm a person who cycles as opposed to a cyclist because... you know, I don't have all the gear and the, you know, people have the cameras and their helmet and stuff like that. I'm a passive person who cycles.
You're a passive person who cycles.
Yeah.
The last thing that I would call the character of Mags, however, is passive. I'm going to play a clip from early on in the film, actually, and she's been beeped at by a pretty obnoxious driver, it has to be said. She's cycling to do a pizza delivery and trying to do that most difficult of things for a cyclist or a person who cycles. She's trying to turn right on a road. Never easy to do. So he has kind of ignored her signal. So she knocks on his window and be warned, Mags is fond of use of the broad F, as is the driver here, it has to be said as well. They both have a bit of language to share with us.
You'll give me to the end of the week, right?
I was turning right.
What the fuck?
I need to be there to turn right.
Get the fuck out of my car!
I'm 3 pizzas away from a new record, so I don't actually have time to get into it. But just because you have a fancy car doesn't mean you own the road, you absolute dickhead. Did you not learn to share as a child?
You're a lunatic!
I bet you had all the toys and no friends.
I have friends. Hey! Just leave my car.
Power windows, do they work?
Leave my car alone.
You should try actually talking to people instead of blasting your loud ass horn at us.
Listen, I'm sorry, but you were in my way.
I was in your way?
Yeah.
I will eat your heart.
Just please, just leave me alone and...
Look, admit you're a dickhead and I let you go.
No. Alright, okay. I'm a dickhead.
Great. And, are these self-closing doors?
What?
Like power doors, is that a thing?
No.
Oh, great. Cheerio.
And she cycles off, of course, leaving the door wide open. That's Roxana McLean as Mags in a scene from the film Bicycle Thieves Pumped. First things first, yeah. Roxana, I wonder to what extent that particular scene and the kind of, because I believe there's a certain amount of improvisation involved in the dialogue and in the script here. Was this born from an experience of your own, that particular scene?
Like I said, honestly, like my main mode of transport is cycling, and it's just impossible. Like, you really can't win anyway. Mm. Thankfully, I can kind of manage my anger a bit better than Mags. But I mean, I bet if you were any kind of delivery person or had to work to a schedule, people, like, honestly, people go out of their way to just make it difficult for you and parking in cycle lanes and then beeping at you when you're turning. Connor as well. Connor knows. Like, it's just like infuriating.
You're mad keen to get in, Connor.
Is a thing that our composer did. Our composer, Rachel Lee Quinn, did that on Parliament Street. She was trying to turn right and someone beeped her and she just opened the door and started chatting to them because they were ignoring her. But she maintains she was much more polite about it than I've depicted in the film. But, you know,
did she
got that energy too.
Yeah, did she cycle off and leave the door open? I think that's the best bit. Because he has to stretch right across, of course, to get at the door to close it, which is part of it. We also get a hint in that scene, Connor. We get a hint. There's a conversation, a telephone conversation going on as he's driving along, and it turns out he's speaking to a tenant. And very quickly, not only is it Mags and her particular predicament regarding anger management on the bicycle, but Mags and her predicament regarding rental accommodation and the housing crisis in Dublin. That all comes up fairly quickly. Did you want to get into that on a serious level, or how did you want to approach it?
Yeah, I don't know. That just kind of came naturally with the territory, I think, because when you're talking about low-wage workers and you're talking about people of Mags's age living in Dublin, the housing crisis is kind of never far from anyone's mind. And with that scene, yeah, she accidentally ruins that guy going to do an eviction just there. And he comes back a number of times throughout the film, and they've got a bit of a dynamic that plays out. But actually, the bulk of that subplot about her housing and situation kind of came about because the landlord I had at the time was trying to get us all out of the building by hook or by crook, you know, sending in the fire officers and all kinds of jazz to try and move us out. Because he wanted to sell off the place.
Right, and there's an interesting thing that she says in the midst of all of that, which gives us an idea of the issue she has around anger. I'm three pizzas away from a record, she says, Roxana. Just explain that to us, if you would.
Yeah, so I suppose, like Connor says, those kind of low pay work, at least the delivery people and people who are for Uber Eats, you really are, like, you have to get there by a certain amount of time. And, you know, so there are actually a lot of workers who put themselves in dangerous situations to try and make their target. Now, for Mags, it's more of a competition with herself. But yeah, she's 100% dependent on her bike for work. And so yeah, when the bike is stolen, it just everything kind of comes crashing down there, because the landlord wants to put up the rent, and it's her livelihood, and it also the bike has sentimental value to her. So it's kind of it really is just the start of a bad week.
when I was first writing the script, I initially thought it was going to be a film that was about anger and about her overcoming her anger. And then I realized partway through writing it, she's right. Like, she's not wrong to be angry at all in any of these situations. And so that's when they kind of all turned and the whole film changed, and it becomes more about community and independence and whether anyone can survive being independent, or whether we need more of a collective to be able to rely on our friends and our communities more, which is what you ultimately kind of comes to recognise over the course of the film.
It has to be said,
she still is angry at the end.
It has to be said that the community that you seem to be relying on a lot in this film, Connor, are the community of the Irish comedy circuit. Quite a few stand-up comedians in there, and you have a background in that area yourself, Connor.
I do indeed. I have been doing stand-up for about 10, maybe 12 years at this point. And when we came around to making the film, I was like, right, usually when people are making a film on a kind of small scale, you'll kind of use very few locations and very few characters. But I was like, I can get like about 60 people out to just kind of give me an afternoon. And so I've cashed in all of my favors that I've been accumulating over the years, and I think it's paid off. it's been very nice how many people are willing to just give me some of their time to play one daft character in one scene of the thing.
Yeah.
It feels very big. It's funny when you watch it back, it feels really big because there are so many different people in it.
Yeah, there's a very big cast. In fact, we're going to go to a scene that features quite a large number of people. We don't hear all of them speaking in the scene. This is the wonderful Bicycle Thieves support group that Mags decides she has to attend. Now, this support group, it's not only for bicycle people who've lost bicycles, but it's also for people who've had unfortunate experiences in operations, because there wasn't enough in either support group to justify having a support group by itself. So you'll hear one of the people who, you'll hear people from both sides of the support group speaking here. And Simon Mulholland plays the facilitator, and Mags as Roxana Nicklaim, or Roxana Nicklaim as Mags is in here.
You've just lost a bike?
Yeah. It was yellow and blue.
It can be really difficult to accept when a bike is gone.
Yeah, but I'm getting mine back, so I don't actually need to do that.
Yeah, sure. Have you considered the possibility that you might not?
No, because I'm getting it back, so...
Okay, sure. But if you don't, we'll all be here for you.
Well, actually, I'm just here for the surgical malpractice.
It's just like, none of you even want to get your bike back, or geez.
I want to get my bike back, but I also want to feel good about myself again.
Yeah, of course. Well, why don't you do that? And I'm actually gonna head, so. See you later.
There we go, a little scene from Bicycle Thieves, the support group, Roxana Nicklaim as Mags, Simon Mulholland as the facilitator, and a couple of the members of the group there as well. You're clearly not
really
a big fan.
Molly Shanahan there, is you?
Yeah, say that again, huh? Connor.
I said, and you Julie J and Pauline Shanahan there were the other two that pop in.
You're not a big fan of the support group, are you?
Oh, you know what? I really like the support group. And actually, what the thing about that is, Simon's character there, we were talking about community earlier, he's really the thematic villain of the film, I think. You know, like he's only in it really for that scene. But he's the one who's like, you know, we're here for you, we'll support you. She's like, no, I'm sorting myself. I'm out of here. This is weird. I'm uncomfortable accepting help. And that's really what's the core of Mags's kind of central problem, you know? She needs to figure out how to accept that, you know, sometimes we all need help from somebody, you know?
Yes, yeah, and it is that if she was a little less independent, perhaps she'd get to a solution a little bit quicker. But I'm wondering from your point of view, Roxana, I mean, you're used to working, particularly when you as on Fair City in the role of Erica, you'd be used to working to a fairly tight schedule, you know, when you're putting out that number of episodes and getting them shot and getting them into place.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of time for messing about, but I would guess that the shoot and the kind of logistics involved in Bicycle Thieves was even more pressurised than the average Fair City week.
Connor's laughing there. No, I don't think so. The great thing about Bicycle Thieves was that it felt very collaborative. Like there was a core group of us from the very beginning before we shot, and that's myself, Connor, the producer Gary Sheridan, and then the director of photography, Owen O'Brien. And so we kind of discussed a lot of ideas. Like Connor had a script that had kind of an idea of what he wanted to happen. But, you know, we all kind of got to have a good bit of input into it. And then that's where you get some. And then sometimes we would have like a cameo in a scene, and they would bring their own energy, or they might throw in a little line of dialogue, or it might become something else about the scene might become funny. Mm-hmm. So whereas obviously if you're on Fair City, there's no room for improvisation, for a good reason. I mean, you just don't have the time. But at the start of each day, we took our time to kind of go through what we wanted to do, the kind of locations we wanted to shoot. It was very there was days when we'd want to shoot somewhere and that couldn't happen for whatever reason, and we'd have to kind of improvise even where we were going to film.
It was very freeform.
Yeah, we found out some days that, you know, you're not allowed to film in parks that have a playground. So that became a thing. And it was like, oh, God. So we had to constantly just kind of.
Yeah.
But it felt like more than anything I've done. I mean, Andrea Riseborough earlier on was talking about theatre earlier on. And that's, I mean, with theatre, you have kind of time for rehearsal and to try things and play things out. And this is the first time that's ever happened to me with a film where I actually, we would try things. Sometimes they failed miserably, but at least we kind of give ourselves the time to try stuff.
Yeah, even in the choices of locations, I think sometimes, Connor, it was calling in favours that you were. Because I was astonished. I thought, there's some amazing houses they're here. There's some great flats, some great locations that you chose. But they were all kind of real locations that you borrowed off pals.
Yeah. I mean, you say it like I chose them, as if they weren't just kind of the only places I could find where my friends actually had houses for any amount of time. Like, I think if I was to make that film now, I just wouldn't have sufficient numbers of friends with apartments in Dublin that I could get into, to be honest.
All right.
It was funny. And like, there's a, you know, like Alison works in the big blue bus in the Bernard Shaw there. That's because couldn't find another pizza restaurant though. Couldn't find anything that looked more like a pizza restaurant that we could shoot in. So we're like, well, this is technically that's gone now.
Yeah,
but then,
exactly.
Then we had the one house, like my one set of friends who are like you know, some kind of orthopedic nurse and a computer scientist, and they own a house. And I was like, perfect, can I use
your house?
That,
yeah.
The only house I have access to.
Well, listen.
And then it was a lot of open streets as well, and it's just anywhere we could go.
Great to speak to the both of you this evening. Congratulations on the film. I presume you'll all be cycling in convoy to the screening on Thursday evening and finding out what the streets of Galway are like to cycle on, since you know so much about the streets of Dublin. Bicycle Thieves, Pumped Up, will be screened outdoors at 6 p.m. That's this Thursday, July the 22nd, Father Burke Park, Father Griffin Road in Galway. You can find out full details on galwayfilmfla.com. And thanks very much to Conor O'Toole, writer and director, and Roxana Lick-Lim, playing the part of Mags in the film, for being with us this evening. Wes Anderson, the American director and screenwriter, is known for his distinctive visual aesthetic, his quirky comedies, and for his work with actors like Owen Wilson, Bill Murray, Adrian Brody, and most recently Tilda Swinton. He's developed a cult following in the film industry. His colour palette and unique forms of storytelling are admired by critics and fans worldwide, and he is cited by many as a modern day example of the auteur. Joining me this evening is Rory Cashin to answer our Tuesday night question, where do I begin with? So where do I begin with the works of Wes Anderson? Rory, I suppose we start, first of all, with where Wes Anderson started. Owen Wilson and a meeting and being friendly with Owen Wilson in his time at college, that was hugely important in Anderson's development.
Yeah, pretty much they met in college while Wes Anderson was studying to get his degree in philosophy, and they became roommates. And Wes Anderson at the time was a projectionist in a cinema, which is, I guess, part of the reason why you fell in love with movie making. It's the exact same story as me. I was a projectionist while I was in college as well, and moved into film journalism. And then they became best friends, and Owen and his brother Luke Wilson, the three of them worked together on a short film called Bottle Rocket, which then became Wes Anderson's first feature film. And they continue to work together for the foreseeable future. Like, I think Owen Wilson is in The French Dispatch, which is the one that was just premiered at Cannes. And I think that makes it like their sixth or seventh collaboration. Now, it's not as many as he's worked with Bill Murray. He's worked with Bill Murray 9 times now. So Wes Anderson has a habit of, if he likes you, he'll keep you around indefinitely.
I guess if you get people to come back again and again, and people of the caliber of Bill Murray and Owen Wilson, well, then you must be doing something right in terms of your filmmaking for the actors who are involved with you.
And like, absolutely, like you can tell everyone in it's a bit like, he reminds me a little bit of Tarantino in that everyone wants to work with him, and he also has like a very specific aesthetic, a very specific way of telling his stories, and he amasses these incredible casts. Like, I've written the one down for The French Dispatch, and I'll be here for the next hour just listing the amount of famous people who are in it. But like, he's getting everyone out. Like, he has Saoirse Ronan coming back a number of times now, which is just like the first of, I think, and I hope, Irish talent he's working with. But yeah, like, it's incredible the amount of people who not only want to work with him but are willing to do tiny roles and do it over and over again.
You mentioned Bottle Rocket, which was first of all a short and then expanded out into a feature film. Owen Wilson part of that film, but that film admired by Scorsese. What did Scorsese admire so much in the making of that film? What was its aesthetic that made people like Scorsese sit up?
I think it was the 1-2 punch of Bottle Rocket and then his second film, Rushmore, that really got Scorsese's attention. He was doing an interview in Esquire, and there's always the question of, like, who's the next Spielberg, who's the next Kubrick, and he was asked to his face, who do you think the next Martin Scorsese is, and he said Wes Anderson, just because he had such a strong stylistic vibe, just because he knew exactly how to storytell and make character first and get amazing performances out of these actors. So it was after Rushmore that Scorsese said, this is the one you need to keep an eye on, because Rushmore was his first collaboration with Bill Murray. We had Jason Schwartzman, I think, co-wrote the screenplay with him, who is the nephew of Francis Ford Coppola. So there's a lot, and there's a lot of like family ties in there, because I know Wes Anderson works a lot with Roman Coppola, who is Francis Ford Coppola's son as well. So that was like the first step towards a very productive relationship between the three of them. And then once Scorsese gave the seal of approval, it was just, it was a way for Wes Anderson, because the next one was Royal Tenenbaums, and I think that was the one that everyone finally was like, ah, this is the guy.
And funny you should mention all those father-son relationships. That's a recurring theme in the work of Anderson.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of capers and hijinks and missing people and things suddenly going missing from like rich people's safes. They're like, I had a very important item, it's gone missing, or someone has just lost a family member. And that kind of comes into the fore with Royal Tenenbaums, where Gene Hackman, in one of his, I think it's one of his last on-screen performances, is the father who's been missing for years and comes back into the fold to try to rebuild relationships with all his family members.
Yeah, you're suggesting to us, in terms of a route into Anderson, though, that we might leave Tenenbaums to the end, but we should start with Grand Budapest Hotel. Mm. Probably his most... Certainly in terms of most box office friendly movie, would that be fair to say?
I think so, yeah. I think it's his most recent live action movie before French Dispatch. It headlines Ralph Fiennes, who, if you've seen In Bruges or if you've seen Hail Caesar with the Coen brothers, he is a phenomenal comedic actor, and I think that's not tapped into enough. And Wes Anderson absolutely gets into that vein with Ralph Fiennes here, and he steals the show so completely. And considering that the rest of the cast is filled with Tilda Swinton and Jeff Goldblum and Adrian Brody and all these actors and actresses that Wes Anderson uses over and over again, Ralph Fiennes just folds into it so perfectly, and it is a fantastic, like, constantly funny comedy.
And that thing that you're saying about actors prepared to come and play small roles, the Grand Budapest Hotel is perfect for that, because it's an hotel, so people can come and go, they can stay for a night or two and then disappear, or they can be long-term people working in the hotel or living in the hotel. Let's listen to a scene, Fiennes plays the concierge here, Monsieur Gustave, and he's looking for a new lobby boy. He's interviewing Tony Revolori, Zero, the character here, as they walk through the bustling lobby of the Grand Budapest Hotel.
Who are you?
I'm Zero, sir, the new lobby boy.
Zero, you say?
Yes, sir.
Well, I've never heard of you, never laid eyes on you. Who hired you?
Mr. Mosher, sir.
Mr. Mosher?
Yes, Monsieur Gustave.
Am I to understand you've surreptitiously hired this young man in the position of a lobby boy?
He's been engaged for a trial period, pending your approval, of course.
Perhaps, yes. Thank you, Mr. Mosher.
You're most welcome, Monsieur Gustave.
You're now going to be officially interviewed.
Should I go and light the candle first, sir?
What? No. Experience.
Hotel Kinski, kitchen boy, 6 months. Hotel Berlitz, mop and broom boy, 3 months. Before that, I was a skillet scrubber.
Experience, zero.
Thank you again, Mr. Gustav.
Straighten that cap, Anatole. The pleasure's mine, Herr Schneider.
The stress busters.
These are not acceptable.
I fully agree.
Education.
I studied reading and spelling. I started my primary school. I almost finished.
Education, zero.
Now it's exploded.
Good morning, Cicero. Call the goddamn plumber.
This afternoon, Monsieur Gustav.
Will that fail, Frau Liebling?
What on earth is this?
Not now. Family.
Zero,
played there by Tony Revolori, and Monsieur Gustave, played by Ralph Fiennes in the Grand Budapest Hotel. Rory Cashin with us this evening with our Where Do I Begin with Wes Anderson spot. That film, in many ways, Grand Budapest Hotel, gives us a real sense of Wes, a particular aspect of Wes Anderson's aesthetic. First of all, the music there. Music is hugely important and it's running right underneath that scene. But the visual aspect of the Grand Budapest Hotel in particular, it's really extraordinary.
Yeah, the reason why I think this is the perfect way in is because I consider this to be Anderson firing on all cylinders, even though, as you said, that the music is fantastic in this, and it's Alexander Desplat, I think, and he won the Oscar for it. And interestingly, most of his previous films are soundtracks. They really highlight a particular artist. And this is the first one that kind of had its own unique
original score.
And it ended up winning the Oscar, and it worked fantastically well. And I think this is his first one as well to actually win Oscars. It was nominated for 9 and it won 4. Anderson hasn't won any for writing or directing, even though he's been nominated for 7 so far. But yeah, as you mentioned, the style of this, the unique kind of cinematography and art direction and costume design, and even the way he frames everything, like it's 90 degrees head on action and sometimes pulls away to show this almost like diorama of a cut down into the hotel, and you see things happening in different rooms simultaneously. It's phenomenal.
It's almost, you know, it isn't animation, but it could so easily be animation, the Grand Budapest Hotel, and it's hardly surprising that animation is a very important part of Anderson's work. Fantastic Mr. Fox, obviously, is in there, but the one that you're going to talk to us a little bit about is Isle of Dogs.
Isle of Dogs, which is a lovely play on words of I love dogs because he loves dogs. It's a stop motion entry for him. It's his second one. If you go back through his career, like to even Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, he loves stop motion animation. It's such a big part of his filmmaking. I think there's also a section of it in The French Dispatch, the new one that's coming out, but this one is solely stop motion animation. It has the most intensely talented voice cast. Like, it's unbelievable the amount of famous people who will come on and say, yes, I'll do one or two lines for Wes Anderson. That's no problem at all. And it is very, very funny. Considering it's basically the story of a boy who's trying to find his lost dog, you wouldn't think there's a lot to it. It's not coming at you with like the emotional heaviness of a Pixar film, but it is so, so funny.
Well, let's have a listen to a scene featuring Ed Norton voicing the part of Rex, and Chief being voiced by Bryan Cranston.
Wait a second. Before we attack each other and tear ourselves to shreds like a pack of maniacs, let's just open the sack first and see what's actually in it. It might not even be worth the trouble.
What do you think? I'm not sure.
Maybe.
Hi.
A rancid apple core, 2 worm-eaten banana peels, a moldy rice cake, a dried-up pickle, tin of sardine, bones, a pile of broken eggshells, an old smushed-up rotten gizzard with maggots all over it.
Okay, it's worth it. Get out of here and don't come back.
You certainly would. Good. Get out of here and not come back if you heard that in whispered into your ear. Ed Norton and Bryan Cranston there in Isle of Dogs. Wes Anderson, our subject for discussion this evening. Rory, we touched on the visual aesthetic that we get in Grand Budapest Hotel, and that's there in the animated side of things as well. But what about the type of worlds that Wes Anderson actually creates, the weirdness of them? How weird are they and how real are they?
Well, I think they're... With Budapest, I think it's more relatable than most. Some of his films maybe make you take you out of it a little bit. I think Life Aquatic is one of his weaker ones because it just goes off the quirky deep end way too much. But with Royal Tenenbaums, I think it really tapped into the vein of most families are dysfunctional in one way or another. And he has given this lovely mosaic of a family that's broken in pretty much every single way that a family can be broken. And we have Gene Hackman, who's playing a truly unlikable man trying to do a decent thing before he figures this might be the last thing he ever does. And again, this is the first time he's kind of coalesced this magnificent cast.
The Wilson brothers are there in this as well.
Yeah, and Ben Stiller and Bill Murray again, and Angelica Houston. Like, the cast is insanely stacked. And this is, I feel, Wes Anderson's kind of boot out into the world where he's like, this is what I'm capable of when I'm given the chance. And this is the one that kind of got everyone's attention.
And rooting something, the kind of aesthetic that he has around a weird and wonderful world, rooting it in a family, does that give it a level of reality that makes it more accessible?
I think because you have a way in with the characters in some way or another, you will then forgive no matter how weird and quirky he goes, to an extent, like, which is why Budapest and Tannenbaum's and Isle of Dogs works so well, is because they are very funny and he describes these characters so intelligently.
That's it. Rory Cashin answering the question for us. Where do I begin with Wes Anderson? Start with the Grand Budapest Hotel, then go to the Isle of Dogs and finish up with the Royal Tannenbaums. And that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound here in Dublin. And thanks to John Doyle in Galway as well. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1.